Today's Teisho will be on case 47 in the Book of Serenity. Case 47 is entitled Zhaozhou's Cypress Tree, Zhoushu's Cypress Tree. Introduction. The cypress tree in the yard, the wind-blown flag on the pole, it's like one flower bespeaking a boundless spring, one drop telling of the water of the ocean. The ancient Buddhas, born periodically, go far beyond the ordinary current, not falling into words and thought. How can you understand verbally? A monk asked Zhaozhou, what is the living meaning of Zen? Zhaozhou said, the cypress tree in the yard. Verse. The bank eyebrows lined with snow, the river eyes contain autumn, the ocean mouth drums waves, the boat tongue rides the current. The ability to quell disorder, the strategy for great peace, old Zhaozhou, stirring up the monasteries, yet never stopping, uselessly expending effort, still the cart is made to fit the groove. Originally without ability, it fills the ravines and gullies. Thank you very much for coming to practice today on this beautiful summer day. This is one of the most famous koans in the Zen tradition. Basically, a monk asked Zhoushu, Japanese people say Zhoushu, a monk asked Zhoushu, what is the meaning of Zen, of Chan? And Zhoushu said, the cypress tree in the yard. That is a koan. This koan, will make absolutely no sense to most people who haven't done Zazen. Because most people who haven't done Zazen approach everything from ordinary consciousness. So the Buddhist view is, and you can test it out for yourself, the Buddhist view is that ordinary consciousness is never going to be satisfying. Never. So the Buddhist view is, you could say, kind of a bleak view. That ordinary consciousness, the ordinary human consciousness, is always going to be unsatisfactory. There are going to be moments of happiness, at moments of sadness, but there's always going to be a kind of unsatisfactory character to ordinary consciousness. So when you're happy, sometimes you're genuinely happy, but if you inspect your happiness, it's often the case that you're worried under the surface. There's a little bit of fear that it's not going to last, I don't know if you've noticed that, but sometimes when you're happy, you might be happy with an undercurrent. There's a sort of an undercurrent. This isn't going to last. And sometimes that makes people throw themselves into what they're doing even more you could almost say desperately, right? If you go on a vacation, for example, please go on a vacation. I love vacations. But we know when we go on a vacation that it's not going to last, right? We can't live our lives on a vacation. And, we have to sort of work very hard to be, quote unquote, carefree, right? Carefree. And to be happy, right? So if you're really self-disciplined, and I hope you are, you'll turn off your cell phone. You won't let the office call you on your vacation. And maybe you'll go down to Mexico. Maybe you'll stay in Cancun or something like that. And basically, it's a little bit artificial. You're going to a world which you know isn't really the world you live in, and you're going to have a good time. But you're going to have a good time by being very careful not to let certain things through the door. One thing you don't want to think about is how much it's going to cost. Right? So if you start thinking about that, your vacation is shot. Right? So you sort of repress that. It's like, okay, I'll put that. I'm not going to think about the cost right now. I'm going to enjoy myself. Now, there's nothing wrong with that. Right? There's nothing wrong with this. This is something we all do. Right? And we all behave this way. But let's be honest. There's a kind of conditionality to our happiness under those circumstances, right? We're working very hard to close certain things out so we don't have to think about them. And we know under the surface, none of this is real, none of this is going to last, right? Now, that doesn't mean it's not wonderful, right? On my 30th, on our 30th wedding anniversary, my wife and I went to Hawaii. I had never been to Hawaii. My wife had been to Hawaii a couple times. And so she really knew Hawaii very well. And we stayed in Honolulu a couple days, and then we went over to Kauai, which is the least spoiled island. It's really magical. And we stayed in these places that are called the, there used to be workers' houses, but now it's like a little resort, basically. You live in this little house. And you have a little kitchen, and you can do whatever you want, and it's right next to the ocean. It was like a dream world, right? I could get up in the morning, and outside there was a mango tree, and there were mangoes. It was like a dream, right? Mangoes on the ground. I said, "Can I pick?" "Oh, yes, help yourself. Eat all the mangoes you want," So, walking along the beach, this beautiful Hawaiian beach. But I know, this is a lot of fun, but I know it's not real in a certain way, right? It's not real. It might be real for the persons who run the place, who mow the grass, but it's not my real life. I'm not going to spend the rest of my life in a farmer's hut in Hawaii eating mangoes, That's not my life, So I have to come back. And so I know that was a beautiful dream. And all the time I'm in that dream, I'm enjoying it, but very cautiously, right? Very cautiously. And if you do get a call, you get an email, you "Oh, damn it, I have to take this call," and I say, "Oh, no," and then we have to get back into the dream. So it's we've invented this thing called a vacation, and it's a wonderful thing, but basically it's not entirely real. And we're always controlling the experience to make sure we don't let in certain things, So, this is quite consistent with the Buddhist view, right? The Buddhist view isn't that you shouldn't go on vacation and have any fun. That's not the Buddhist view. But that kind of fun is carefully controlled, right? Carefully controlled. And a lot of life, in ordinary consciousness, is not like that, right? So on your vacation, you get up, you can sleep late, you don't have to get to work, you can eat food maybe you wouldn't allow yourself to eat at home because, a lot of calories. So you think, "Well, what the heck? It's my vacation. I'm going to have, and eat a bunch of stuff." And maybe stay up too late, maybe have too much to drink, and it's my vacation. It's my vacation. So, when you get back home, you get the mail, and there's all the bills, and then you get to work, and there's a big problem. "Thank God you're back. While you were away, this happened," right? It's like, "Uh-oh," and then you're working very hard to clean it up. You're anxious. A week after your vacation, you could think, "What happened to my beautiful vacation buzz?" I have we have a new dean in the English department reports to a new dean. He's the dean of Arts and Sciences at Rutgers. And he's a very smart man. He's a mathematician, and I like him very much. But, you know, whenever I walk outside, sometimes I spend so many hours at my desk, I have to get up and force myself to just walk around the block three or four times. Or I'll walk to lunch. I always make a point of getting out of my office and eating lunch somewhere besides my office, which I have been in for 28 years, right? You know, so I don't like to eat lunch in my office. So I'll go out and I'll walk, and there's the dean, and he's walking around the block chain-smoking cigarettes, which is something you don't see so much anymore. He's about 60 years old, but he's out there, and I see him thinking, and smoking. And you know, I know he's smoking to get rid of the pressure, you know. So you know, a cigarette, it gives him a little nicotine rush. But it also, you know, smoking is actually like a way of rewarding yourself, actually, you know. So you know, if you're a smoker, you actually sort of unconsciously calculate, you know, you think, okay, if I do this, I'm going to have a cigarette. You know, when I'm done, I'll have a smoke. So it's like at the end of this task, there's a reward. It's a cigarette. And, you know, it is satisfying. You get a little nicotine rush, and you feel better. So then there's another task, and then you do that task, and then you have a smoke. You know, and sometimes the task is taking too long, and you're frustrated, and you think, I'm too frustrated. I need a smoke now, right? So this is like the smoker's mind, you know. I know this because so many people in my family were smokers. And so, you know, this is a habit that people pick up that sort of reveals something about everyday reality, right? You know, he's a dean. He's a well-known mathematician. He looks like a cool cat, I have to say. You know, he's a very handsome man, very composed. He's from Canada, and he has a slightly British style, so he's very cultured. But underneath all of that, there's an anxious man who's chain smoking, right? And I think that makes him more endearing and more likable, you know, because you can see a little vulnerability there. The point is that his ordinary consciousness is like our ordinary consciousness, right? You know, a lot of the time we're it's an unsatisfactory situation. You know, there's a lot of anxiety, there's a lot of stress, there's a lot of fear, right? And that's all part of the package of ordinary consciousness. You know, and by the way, I saw the dean a few days ago, and I said, "How are you doing?" And he stopped smoking, and he said, "Oh, very good." And I said, "Where are you going for vacation?" And he said, "I'm going to Costa Rica," and there's a town in Costa Rica he likes to go to, and he likes to surf. Who would have guessed a surfing dean? Which is great. I like that idea. But you know, never, you know, and I'm sure when he goes to surf, you know, he turns his cell phone off. He's out there on the waves, you know, beautiful waves. The sun catches the waves, and you know, and when he comes back to his office, he, you know, probably that lasts for a while. You know, you wake up in the morning, you're just thinking of the waves outside of, you know, that hit the shore of Costa Rica. After our Hawaiian vacation for like a month, I'd be doing something, and all of a sudden my mind would flash back to like the turtles swimming in the water. And it was just wonderful. I'm so glad I went to Hawaii. I'm so glad I swam with the turtles, you know. Very cool. But, you know, ordinary consciousness has this quality, right? There's an undercurrent that's a little bit unsatisfactory. And the Buddha says, look, don't think you can ever make it right, you know, using ordinary consciousness. This is the Buddha's view. It might not be your view, but this is the Buddha's view. And feel free to test it out in your own life. But the Buddha said, you know, you can go to Hawaii, but there's going to be an undercurrent of anxiety even there. You know, you can go to Costa Rica and surf, but you know, you will be reaching for your cigarettes all the same, because there's going to be some anxiety. That ordinary consciousness is unsatisfactory. And you can go on vacation. You know, you read these things. I was just reading yesterday. I'm sorry I read it, but I read it. I was reading the Huffington Post, and on the corner of my eye, there was a story about Paris Hilton's sister, Nikki Hilton. Naturally, I couldn't not read it, right? So Nikki Hilton is getting married to James Rothschild. You know, the Rothschilds are this very rich European banking family. So, you know, it confirmed my view that, you know, the world is not fair, right? You know. So Nikki Hilton, heir to the Hilton Hotel fortune, is marrying, you know, James Rothschild, heir to the Rothschild banking fortune. But then I thought, well, who is this James Rothschild? So I Googled him. And he is indeed very wealthy. And his father committed suicide. So, you know, that makes him a more human character to me. Makes him a more, makes James Rothschild more likable, actually. Because, you know, all that money and his father, by the way, his father was a hard-charging guy, very effective person, well-educated, sat on a pile of money and made more. He got into all these ventures, and one day he committed suicide. So, you know, so even if you're a Rothschild, you know, you have, you know, you know, there's something unsatisfactory about your consciousness. Even a Rothschild, you know, your riches, you're so rich, you have nothing to worry about. You know, even if you lose a lot, you still have a lot. You don't have to go out investing. You know, you can just get up every morning in Kauai and pick up your check. But you know, people find a way to be unhappy even under those circumstances. And the Buddhist view is that is because of the way ordinary consciousness works. See? And so whether you go to Kauai or you go to, you know, Costa Rica, whether you're a Rothschild or whether you're the dean of the arts and sciences faculty at Rutgers or whether you know, it's all going to be the same. You aren't going to be able to escape the limits of this. You know, that's the Buddhist view. And the Buddhist view is that the reason you can't escape this situation is because ordinary consciousness is centered on what we say in Zen is the small self, the small personal self. So, you know, all day long, if you're in ordinary consciousness, you're worried about me. You know, this is normal and human. We're hardwired to do this, right? All day long we get up and we worry about me. So, you know, I wake up in the morning and, you know, I try to meditate every day. But, you know, I get up very early. I'll get up at 5 o'clock. And one of the first things I ask myself is, what would I like to have for breakfast? You know. So it's like, Kurt, what would you like for breakfast? You know, I could have, you know, I have wheat-free waffles in the icebox. I can have my usual breakfast of chickpeas and brown rice. I could have yogurt with fresh fruit, you know. So, you know, it's like, what would you like, you know? You know, I could make yogurt with fresh fruit and then think, oh, damn it, I should have had the waffles, you know. See, this is ordinary consciousness. And then, you know, I'm driving to work and I'm thinking, uh-oh, you know, that if we don't get that grant, we're going to be short $40,000. So, you know, the whole time I'm driving, I don't see the road, I don't see the trees. You know, I'm thinking, I have anxiety, I'm worried about the grant. You know, and you know, all day long, this is sort of how we live. We're constantly taking care of me, you know. So if you go to meet the dean, you know, you want to do your business, but you're behind wanting to be effective. You know, there's also this anxiety. It's like, I want this person to think well of me. What if he doesn't think well of me? You know, I have a friend of mine who's written 5 books. And you know, and he said to me once that he feels like an imposter. Right? It's like, well, if you're the imposter, you know, I don't know who the real thing could be. But it's because, you know, we inhabit this small self. You know, the small self is always imagining itself as needy, needy, you know, lonely, needy, helpless, vulnerable. And this goes back to a time when we were needy, helpless, vulnerable, and probably a little lonely. You know, so we're always trying to take care of this self. And we're always coming from this place which is sort of like a deficit model of the self, right? So, you know, we're always trying to take care of the self. We're always needy. We're always frightened. And we're trying to be safe. We're trying to be happy. You know, you get, what would you like? You know, yogurt? Waffle? You know, and all day long we're doing this. It's possible to be hard on yourself and say this is just selfishness. But I don't think that's true. I think a lot of the reason we're in the small self is habit, right? Habit. And also, you know, it comes from a place of fear a lot of the time. Fear. You know, and there is a fear, loneliness, sense of not having been taken care of in the past, you know. We carry around this needy, frightened person sometimes inside of ourselves. And we're always trying to protect it and also cheer it up a little bit, right? You know. So this is ordinary consciousness. All day long we're taking care of this. And there's a kind of problem with this strategy, right? There's a problem with this strategy. Because no matter what you do, it's always going to be unsatisfactory, right? So I have a friend of mine who's a book agent. A few years ago, I tried to not write an academic book. I tried to write a popular book on Buddhism. And I wrote like 350 pages. And I gave it to a friend of mine who was a book agent. And she was too polite to say, this needs to be revised. She just said, let me look and see if I can't find a publisher for you. But she tried to warn me that the book might be rejected because she said, you know, I work with some of the best authors in the world, and she does. Let me just say before I finish my point, one day when we were meditating together up in North Jersey, we were finished meditation, and I said, what are you going to do today? And she said, I'm copy editing a book by a popular writer. And I said, anybody I know? And she said, have you heard of Tom Clancy? I don't know. That's supposed to be the punchline. But Tom Clancy is a famous, famous writer whose books sell millions of copies. So this woman is a serious writer. You know, I mean, serious editor. She does the best, right? So anyway, she told me, look, you know, I work with many authors, and it's always the same thing. You know, when they finish their manuscript, they're terribly unhappy because they haven't found a book agent. She said, once we find a book agent, they're terribly unhappy because it could have been a better agent, right? She said, then the book agent looks for a press, right? And if they don't find a press, they're terribly unhappy because their book agent couldn't find a press. But if they find a press, guess what? They're terribly unhappy because it's not the best press, right? This is actually very much human nature. So then, you see, if it comes out into print, they go to Google, I mean, they go to Amazon, and they look at the ranking of the book, right? And they watch Amazon's rankings every day, and if the book isn't in the top 100, right, you know, basically, when you get down to the top 1,000, you're really not selling many books. So when you get to the top, if you're not in the top 100 or the top 50, you know, that's a problem. But even if you are, guess what you worry about? How long will you stay? Right? So this is ordinary consciousness. It's always the same for all of us, right? All of us. You know, we might have the strength not to check on Amazon to see what ranking our book is. And if we do, it will be devastating, right? But even if we don't do it, you know, we want to do it, and we worry about it, right? I mean, I was reading something the other day about Ernest Hemingway. And Hemingway, you know, his second book came out, and it was so popular. It's this amazing book called The Sun Also Rises. And it's an amazing book. It's beautiful. And it came out, and it made his career. So, you know, he was the envy of every writer of his generation. And he was handsome, and he was dashing, you know. And he was so handsome, they used him for beer advertisements in Life magazine. It shows him landing a big marlin and having a beer, right? And he's this incredibly handsome man. So Hemingway had it all, you know. But, you know, he was constantly trying to compete with his own best book. And he was, he developed a serious problem with alcoholism. Because he was, is this is going to be as good? Every time he sat down, is this going to be as good as the Sun Also Rises? You know, and so you can, you know, he's competing with himself in an unwinnable situation. Right. So Hemingway had it all. Best writer of his generation, famous, people flocking for his autograph, you know, etc., became a serious alcoholic, and after a while couldn't write. You know, poor guy. He was so uneasy writing that he would stop writing to go out and waste time with his friends. And then when he would waste time with his friends, he would be guilty because he wasn't writing. And this vicious circle, right? You know. So he hated, by the way, to be alone. Hemingway didn't like to be alone. And of course, if you're a writer, you have to be alone. So he'd get lonely when he wrote, and he'd go find his friends. And when he was with his friends, he was happy, but he was guilty that he wasn't writing. So each of these is an occasion to drink. So this is somebody who, I mean, I myself have been writing something, and I read this story about Hemingway with interest, because, of course, I feel the same way, you know. When I'm writing, I feel lonely. I'm by myself in my room, you know. When I'm not writing and I'm with my friends, I feel happy, but I feel guilty because I'm not writing. So this is human nature, right? And the Buddha said, if you live this way, you'll have your ups, you'll have your downs, but you'll never really be, there'll always be something missing that doesn't have to be the case. So even though it might not always happen to you, if you keep meditating, you will find that when you sit on the cushion, sooner or later, you're going to enter an altered state of consciousness. An altered state of consciousness. And it will happen to you, you know, if you just persist. You know, when you meditate, you have pain in your legs, you have pain in your back. You know, sometimes it's hard to focus on your breath. But eventually, what will happen to you is when you sit down the cushion, you will enter an altered state of consciousness. And you will, I talked to somebody the other day who would come to sit in the evening. And I said, how was your sit? And this is somebody who I think had gotten a little discouraged and maybe stopped sitting for a while, but had given it another try. And I said, how was your sit? And the person said, amazing. He said, you know, I felt, I don't know even how to describe it. He said, I felt like I was empty, my body was empty and enormous inside. Something like that, you know. That's not how you might experience deep concentration, but that's how he experienced it on that occasion. And what makes it special is not, it would be cool to feel your body hollow and enormous, but that's really not the goal. It's just that you're in an altered state of consciousness. And in that state of consciousness, you're not worried about your little self all the time, you know. You're in a very different mental place. One day you'll sit down on the cushion if you just persist. And it can be hard and frustrating. I've been doing this for 40 years. You know, meditation was not easy for me to start with. I had a lot of physical pain, very difficult. But I would get down on the cushion, and sometimes it would just be like heaven. I would just be in this beautiful place where I felt so, you know, sort of like blissful or just very, very happy for no reason, you know, for no reason. I would come into the Zendo on a Saturday, and I would sit, and the first thing I would say to myself when I would come in and sit down on the cushion is, I shouldn't be here, I should be working on my dissertation. And I would feel guilty, and I would sit there for the first maybe 15 or 20 minutes worrying about my dissertation. Then, you know, I would begin to have pain in my legs, and I would have to focus on my breath. And after a while, I just didn't care about my dissertation. I just wanted to get through the sit, which is a big improvement. Big improvement. You know, and maybe a couple hours into the Saturday meditation, I would be in such a different place. Every once in a while, I would get into this place where I just felt wonderful. And I would get off the cushion at the end of the morning, and I just felt wonderful. And if somebody said to me, how's it going with the dissertation? I would say, terrible. Right? But for some reason, it wouldn't bother me so much, right? It wouldn't bother me. At least at that time, it wouldn't bother me. I could almost laugh at it, you know, like, terrible. You know, but you're in a different place. You know, this is so important. We don't have to live in the small self. It's a shame that people spend so much time in that ordinary self when they could be living in another world, really, that's a much better place, right? So all it takes is a commitment to practice meditation. And sooner or later, you're going to start entering this state which is very happy for no reason. It's just the sheer happiness of being connected to the world, right? You know, as I said earlier, you know, when we are going through our day in our ordinary consciousness, it's all about the small self, you know, the small self. But you know, if you look at your ordinary consciousness, please notice how often you feel isolated or disconnected from the things around you. I think it's quite commonplace, you know. So, you know, I myself can be quite disconnected from my surroundings. You know, the other day I had to go to this committee meeting that I did not want to go to. The committee is, you know, if you're not involved in the world I live in, you know, let me just say that in the academic world, people hold meetings all the time. And sometimes you have to go, and these meetings can go on for a long time and nothing gets accomplished, right? Nothing. Sometimes they're very valuable. I go to some meetings and you get things done. You make arrangements, you plan out, and you go and do it. That's great. But sometimes meetings are like, it's like running in molasses. You know, nothing ever happens. So there's this committee I had to go to again. And I actually was dreading it. I said, you know, maybe I won't go, maybe I've got to go. So I went, and you know, it was just as I thought, nothing got done, right? And the chairman of the committee is this guy who just likes to hear himself talk. I mean, there's no other explanation for it, right? And if you think about his anxieties, right, he's probably knows things, the committee's not doing much, so he's trying to fill it up. You know, I don't know what's going on, but I was definitely tuned out of the meeting. Right, you know, I was 10% there and 90% in Kauai, maybe, let's say. Okay, so we go through a lot of our life like this, you know, and sometimes it's protective, right? We're separate from everything else because we want to be. But sometimes we're separate from everything else and we don't want to be separate, right? We feel isolated or locked out, you know, when I was young, I used to do a lot of hitchhiking. And I remember hitchhiking through Oregon one very cold winter, trying to get down to New Mexico, and walking through this town at night thinking, where am I going to sleep? And I walked by this house, and inside I could see in the house, oh, it was a happy family in a warm living room. You know, I thought, oh, I would love to be in that house right now, you know. I think we're all like that sometime, right? You know, we're all on the outside looking in, thinking, oh, I would like to be... You walk in, you go to lunch, and you see some people you know, and you're thinking, oh, I wish they had invited me to their lunch, you know. So sometimes we choose to be detached or separate. Sometimes we're separate through no choice of our own. So this is another aspect of the self. You know, we're always a little bit outside. We're not 100% present a lot of the time. And, you know, so the self is always in an unsatisfactory condition for many reasons, but one of them is that it's always distanced from the world. Even when you go to Hawaii, you can feel distanced, right? So anyway, when you do meditation, you know, and you're not in your small self, you know, it could have happened to you this morning even. You know, we did two periods of meditation. That's very purifying. It really shifts you into an altered state of consciousness. And you go outside and you look at the trees and you just feel so connected to the trees around you, or you feel so connected to the feeling of cold cement, cool cement on your feet. It's like you become the cement. You become the sound of the katydids. You become the trees. You know, this will happen. If it hasn't happened to you, it will happen to you. You know, that sense of a separation between you and the world goes away, and you begin to feel very, very happy. And you don't know why, but it's because that sense of disconnect has gone away. And once that starts to happen to you, you will really look forward to it. You know, I was reading something the other day that I thought was so interesting, you know. It's by a man who is an environmental scientist and also an educator. And he said, you know, he said, Western people think about life in terms of the self and others. The self and others. And I think that's very true. You know, especially in the modern world and in the West, we do, you know, put a lot of emphasis on the me. And we think it, when we think about the world, we think of me and others. He said this is a very typical way Westerners think. But he said actually in some cultures, people don't think that way. They don't think about me and others. They think in terms of the part and the whole. Part and whole. Well, I think when you're in the small self, you're thinking of me and others. Right? When you're in samadhi mind, when you're in that altered state of consciousness, you feel like you're part of something bigger. You're a part of a whole. See? And when you feel that way, you don't necessarily think it, right? Because you can't think your way into that wholeness. You can't. As soon as you start thinking, you create a separation. As soon as you start thinking with your discriminating mind, you distance yourself from the world. But when you enter deep samadhi on the cushion, you experience the wholeness without even having to give it a name. And it's why you feel so good. You know, you feel maybe sometimes a deep sense of well-being or trustingness when you're in deep samadhi. And, you know, the Buddhist view is that, you know, many people think of meditation this way, that meditators go into a trance. And I've even been using the word alternate reality, the term alternate reality. But the Buddhist view is that everyday mind is not real. It's delusional, and that samadhi mind is real. See, so in sometimes if you read Buddhist sutras, you'll hear this phrase that the Buddhist sutras refer to what they're called upside down views. It says ordinary people have upside down views, and you might think, what does that mean, upside down views? It means that people think that ordinary mind is reality. And that if there are other forms of consciousness, are like trances. But the Buddhist view is that ordinary mind is quite unreal and quite unsatisfactory, and it's a fantasy land, actually. But that samadhi mind is real. Samadhi mind is the real mind, is real, really experiencing the world as it is, as it is. So this is what this koan is all about. You know, a monk asked Joshu, what is the living meaning of Buddhism? Now, you know, Joshu could have said, you know, basically the Buddha taught the four noble truths. In Buddhism, there are these four noble truths. And then the Eightfold Path, he could have talked about big mind and little mind. He could have talked about self and other versus part and whole, see. And talking about it like that might be useful under some circumstances. But it doesn't, you know, thinking doesn't take you to that other place, that wholeness. You can't think your way into wholeness, believe it or not. Even though we try over and over again. We have to experience wholeness by being in a samadhi mind. Right? And by the way, you know, that's another reason that somebody like Hemingway was so unhappy, really, really unhappy. You know, you can't think your way or write your way into wholeness. You can write about wholeness, but you know, as soon as you begin to analyze or make decisions about what you will accept and what you will reject, you're already separating yourself. In samadhi mind, you are open to whatever happens. You become with, one with, everything as it unfolds. So please practice Zen and you will see this truth for yourself. So Zhaozhu says, when he's asked what is the essence of Zen, he doesn't say the four noble truths, the Eightfold Path. He doesn't talk about the stages. He doesn't talk about samadhi. He just says, look out there. Look out there. And out in the courtyard of the temple is a cypress tree. You know, I am married to somebody who is an avid gardener. And when I married my wife, if somebody had said cypress tree, I would have had no idea what a cypress tree is. I used to point to all these different trees and just say, those are pines. And my wife would shake her head and she'd go, no, that's a spruce, that's a fir, this is a Douglas fir, this is something else, and this is a pine. And this is a white pine, and this is a jack pine. So now I know trees. So a cypress tree is always evergreen, is evergreen tree. Cypress is a big evergreen. So sometimes this is mistranslated. This is actually translated as the oak tree in the courtyard, but it's not an oak tree, it's a cypress tree. Cypress tree is always green. It's green in the winter, it's green in the summer. See, it's always alive, always alive. So the monk says, what's Zen all about? And Joshu says, the cypress tree in the courtyard. Now, the monk looks at the cypress tree and he thinks, what could that mean? And he's thinking, cypress tree? Cypress tree? How could that, you know, what could that mean? Maybe it's a symbol of something. You know, cypress tree is green, always alive. Maybe he's trying to tell me that. Or maybe the monk thinks, I've got to show Joshu that I'm not a worthless person. I've got to say something interesting about the tree. Or maybe he's thinking, oh, I think this Joshu is a big phony. You know, I think Joshu's nuts. You know, he's supposed to be great, but he's just a windbag. So the monk might not see it right now because he's in his small mind. See. But eventually, if he does enough zazen, he's going to become one with the tree. He's going to experience, without reflecting on it, his oneness with the tree. And that is reality. And that is the road to incredible happiness. Incredible happiness. Please believe me. Introduction. The cypress tree in the yard, the wind-blown flag on the pole. It's like one flower. All you need to do is see one flower and it opens a door to boundless spring. It's like one drop. Just if you see one drop, you're in contact with the ocean. See? It's part and whole. Part and whole. The ancient Buddhas, born periodically, go far beyond the ordinary current, not falling into words and thought. That's what separates us. Okay. A monk asked Zhao Zhou, what is the living meaning of Zen? Zhao Zhou said, the cypress tree in the courtyard. Okay. Verse. See, the bank eyebrows lined with snow, the river eyes contain autumn, the whole world, the hills with snow, the rivers, the oceans, all of this is your face. This is your real body. We feel separate, but that's an illusion. Everything is your true self. You know, when my second teacher was training at Myoshinji, all the wash basins, all the wash, the sinks where monks wash their faces, and they wash it with ice water, by the way, in the morning. They just get water out of the lake and pour it into a big tank, and you pour it into the sink and you wash your face. It's 20 degrees, and you wash your face with ice water. But the sink says there are four characters. Chinese and Japanese writing. There's four characters, and the characters are I only know wholeness. I only know wholeness. See, if you can get into samadhi, all you know is wholeness. If you live in the ordinary consciousness, all you know is separation. The bank eyebrows lined with snow, the river eyes contain autumn, the ocean mouth drums waves, the boat tongue rides the current. The ability to quell disorder, the strategy for great peace. Old Zhao Zhou, stirring up the monasteries, yet never stopping, uselessly expending effort. We are doing something today that's totally useless. Still, the card is made to fit the groove. Originality without ability, it still fills. Originally without ability, it still fills the ravines and the gutters, the gullies. So, please continue to practice Zen. You won't be disappointed.